The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to a new Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, and the show is named after the charity I founded 13 years ago to help people understand and access integrative medicine for cancer. This week is all about connectedness. I'm going to be talking to a seasoned nutritionist, Kirsten Chick, about nutrition, stress, and immunity, and the many ways in which these are interconnected. Kirsten had cancer herself some two decades ago, and has made a specialism of supporting people with cancer. I'm talking to her over Skype in Brighton.
Hi, Robin.
It's been a little while since you were on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk.
Likewise.
I'm really looking forward to looking into the developing understanding of connectedness. I wanted to talk about these three things which are going to be in your forthcoming Yes Life talk: nutrition, stress, and your immune system, and the connections between them. So Orthodox medicine has long chosen to look at the human body as a bunch of separate parts, like a washing machine, but I think you'll agree that there's no escaping that, although up to a point this might pass as a working model for some simple interventions, it's never actually true, and the effects of any intervention have much wider implications than is generally acknowledged.
Oh, exactly. And the more we start to think of the body like an ecosystem, the more helpful it will be, because we're now starting to get used to applying that model to the planet and drawing connections between things that we do to the planet on one level and how it affects the whole ecosystem and the whole food chain. And now we need to start borrowing from that understanding and applying it to the human body, because it's no different.
Right. Okay, well, we're going to go into all of that. So you're a nutritionist with many years' experience helping people with cancer.
Yeah.
But we're talking today about stress and the immune system from a nutritionist's perspective. These are very interesting and growing areas of understanding. But first, I wanted to explore another remarkable feature about the inseparability of the elements and the systems that make up the body, the two-way nature of the connections. For example, nutrition can affect stress levels, but it's also true that stress can affect how we take in nutrition. Now, would you like to say a bit about these two-way relationships?
Yeah, and it's something, you know, we like to chase what's the cause, what's at the root of things.
Yes.
When we find a kind of circular route and we can't really find the beginning of it, somehow as human beings we struggle with that, but actually it's a very beautiful and tight concept that everything's actually continually affecting each other. But we can draw out individual strands and look at them, and a nice one to look at is the connection between the brain and the major organs in the body, which includes the digestive system, also the lungs, the heart, and more. And there's a network of nerves called the vagus nerve. And it's always thought in the past that the vagus nerve was the brain's way of giving instructions to the vital organs in the body. Mm. But we've more recently learned that actually most of the communication is the other way around, from the bottom up. So it's relaying information back to inform the brain, to tell the brain how to respond. And then then the rest of the information is coming back from the brain down. So it's a loop of information, but so much more of it is going to the brain than we really thought. The kind of old model is that the brain is at the top of the castle directing everything, and now we know it's not as straightforward as that. And actually, if you then put the vagus nerve and everything it's attached to back into the body, it's connected in just almost limitless ways to everything else. So you'll see that although that's a nervous system thing where we've got signals running along nerves, it will also feed and be fed by communication from hormones. So people like to separate out, oh, this is a nervous thing and this is a hormonal thing. Mm-hmm. Actually, these systems work so closely together, you can't really do that. So that's one example of how things are working two directions and also branch out to influence lots of different things.
Interesting. Yeah, is the old kind of view is a bit linked, I think, to the kind of liking that humanity has had for top-down systems. These are equally well are beginning to be seen as not the best way of looking at things. But seeing the brain as kind of like in charge, it really is a bit like, the head of a corporation or something.
Exactly, and we're really comfortable with those models. Mm. As paradigms change with the way that we view how society works and how people work, then that enables our views to change in terms of how the bodies work. And it will be really interesting to see how we're viewing all of that in a few hundred years' time, maybe in a way that we can't possibly imagine now.
I think it probably will be, yeah. Okay, another area of connectedness I'd like to explore a little before we get going on the detail is the much wider connectedness of the human body with the environment. You already mentioned this at the beginning. I'd like to say that exactly the same two-way interchange exists, that what we do affects our environment and our environment affects us. And this, of course, can be positively or negatively. Do you want to say a little bit about your understanding of this?
Yeah, so this can work on lots of levels. So in terms of our physical environment, there are lots of ways that we can measure the impact of our physical environment. So things, just simple things like temperature, will affect how our body systems work. Our bodies might have to work a bit harder to adjust temperature so that our internal temperatures are better suited to what needs to happen within our bodies. We may need to sweat more. We may need to drink more water. So just a simple thing like a temperature change can have an effect. We're learning more and more about the effects of light on the body, and how if we are getting up when the sun rises and chilling out and going to bed when the sun sets, then there's lots of different activity in our body that's triggered by different levels of light. So if we expose ourselves to that and we're outdoors a lot, then things happen a lot more smoothly in the body. So light, temperature, there are a couple of things that can really influence this. Things like that being in nature, there's the whole kind of Japanese thing about forest bathing that someone was reminding me of earlier today, and how just the very sense of, or the very presence of trees and nature and just spending time in that, many of us have felt for a long time the benefits, and now science is starting to look at what those benefits might come from. So we're starting to be able to measure those influences as well. We've got a long way to go, but it's all starting to happen. Mm. And then, of course, there's the impact of stress. And in my view, stress is quite a broad encompassing description. So stress can be things like having difficult relationships or deadlines or financial worries or health worries or things like that. But stress can equally be living in a very built-up environment with a lifestyle or working patterns that mean that you're slightly out of sync with the sun and the seasons. It can mean all sorts of stresses. It could be electromagnetic stress. It could be the kind of stress that comes from eating foods that your body finds challenging a lot of the time. So if you have an intolerance to mushrooms, for example, I don't know many people that do, but if say you have an intolerance to mushrooms or to shrimps or something like that, and you ate them every day, that would be a stress on your system that your body would have to deal with, and it would take up valuable resources, it would trigger immune responses, it would take up quite a lot of energy and trigger similar stress responses to having a row with your next door neighbour, for example. So there's certain pathways that will be triggered in a similar way by lots of different kinds of stresses. Right. And they can build up as well. So all of those things around us can have an impact. Fortunately, on the other hand, we have a lot of capacity to regulate our internal environment. Like I said, with temperature, if it's hot outside, we can put things in place that will help keep us the temperature we need to be. So if we've got a lot of stress in our lives, we have internal processes that can help us manage and keep on top of those stresses. So that our bodies are pretty phenomenal in that way. But all of that does take up a lot of energy and resources. We need to make sure that we're putting that back in and we're replenishing that. And at times in our lives, sometimes we can get quite overloaded and overwhelmed with all of those stresses. And so in those situations, our bodies need perhaps a bit of a helping hand to deal with that. So it is a two-way street. And actually, the better we are at dealing with everything, and the more everything's kind of flowing well and working beautifully internally, then the more we'll be able to contribute to our environment and be a positive force within it. So everything works in many directions.
It's quite a kind of amazingly complex tapestry, a great network, isn't it, of cause and effect everywhere.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it really is quite amazing and quite humbling. And I've been diving into research on the human body and working with people for so many years now. You know, it's been a decade and a half now, which is nothing compared to some people's research, but still quite a lot. And I'm kind of just really humbled by how amazing the human body and the planet is. And to think that we can in any way control that or fully understand that, put it into a box and say, we know this is how it works and therefore we can do this and that will happen. We're so far from that. Mm-hmm. But rather than feeling powerless about that, actually I'm more in awe every day of what the human body can do. It's itself, and that actually we need to trust its processes a lot more and support them rather than try and barge our way in.
It feels like it's a bit more akin, you know, there's the one view would be something like trying to control the sea, and the other one is getting out there and getting very skilled on a surfboard and having fun on the sea as it is.
Yeah, I love that analogy. Brilliant.
Quite importantly, I think, we're talking about the environment, we can't always change our environment, of course. It may be stressful, it may be toxic in some way, but we always do have a choice to change the way we respond to it, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And there are lots of ways that we can address this, and there are lots of modalities and people that can help out there on various different levels. So there are people who work with talking therapies, so counselling, psychotherapy, those kinds of things. There are people that work on kind of those levels, but more somatically. So rather than that I suppose there's that view of rather than reinforcing a trauma by talking about it, just finding where it's storing tension or holding patterns in the body and helping the body to release those. So there's some really interesting stuff out there working on those levels, which I think is really, really can be really helpful. But there's whole biochemical processes that we can look at as well. So the adrenal system is our fight, flight, freeze system, and it works primarily with hormones, but it's also connected very tightly to the nervous system and that communication system. So we talk about our nerves responding to stressful events and traumas, but the nerves and the hormones respond together in slightly different ways sometimes. And we think of those, sometimes we can think that they can get a bit out of control and run away, but actually they are part of a physical body, which, yes, it's complex and we can't necessarily fully understand it or dictate to it or control it, but we can feed it.
Yes.
And it's like anything, you give it the right food and space as well, and then it's got a much better chance of sorting itself out and regulating itself. Mm. And that's what most people don't realise, is that you can feed your nervous system, you can feed your hormonal system, you can nourish those just as much as you can feed any other aspect of your body. So hormones need certain nutrients to be made and to be transported around the body, and nerves need certain nutrients to transmit their signals, and there are specific nutrients that help regulate hormones and regulate the nervous system. So there, where the adrenals may have been overfiring for years, if somebody's been in a stress state for many years, and this could be because their stresses and traumas are ongoing, mm-hmm. or it could be that the stress or trauma from years ago hasn't been fully resolved and their bodies are still stuck in a pattern of responding to that. There's actually nutrients that will help your adrenals rebalance from that and back down, step down from that kind of red alert position, if you like. Mm. The first one of those I ever discovered was vitamin B5. And interestingly, I discovered that when I was doing my nutrition exams and I was really stressed about them. And I was trying to revise, do my revision, because we had quite intensive exams at the college where I train. And I was in such a state of stress that I couldn't focus on anything. And that's one of the classic things that happens, because your brain changes how it functions, how it operates in the face of a threat. So cognitive stuff like learning and processing information and being logical and rational type stuff, we don't have time for that right now. We just have to either head towards safety or deal with the threat. It's very simple and instinctive. So all of that cognitive stuff kind of gets shut down. And that's what I was experiencing. So I couldn't learn any of this stuff. And of course, the more I couldn't learn it, the more stressed I got about it. And it came to a point where all I could focus on was the middle of this page. And it was a page all about B vitamins. And it said vitamin B5 helps calm the adrenals down when stressed. I ordered some,
right.
And it arrived the next day. I just instantly felt calmer. And I know that's one example. It could have been the placebo effect. Quite frankly, I don't care if it was, it worked. But actually, there's quite a lot of evidence and research and knowledge around vitamin B5 having that effect. and it's one that's been in my toolkit ever since. And there are other B vitamins that help the adrenals calm down, and things like zinc and magnesium and various nutrients that you can work with. But B5 will always be a go-to for me. It's very rare that doesn't have the desired effect. So yes, we can have an instant, we can have a really beneficial effect on those systems, not in trying to force them into a behavior, but saying, here, have some of this, and if you can, then you can use it to calm down. I was in a position where I could do that. I've come across people where their stress, their trauma is so intense that their body's just going to go, B5, I can't work with that. What am I supposed to do with that? There's no way. So you have to gently ease a little bit more flow and nourishment into the body in other ways before it can actually work with that B5. But there... Yeah, it's very doable, and it's a very lovely way to work.
Well, of course, stress is practically always a partner on the road when you've got cancer, intermittently, if not most of the time. And so to have a completely different approach to helping yourself through that is really useful.
And most people, not everybody, but most people that I see that have had a cancer diagnosis, have a new stress of their diagnosis piled up on top of all the old stresses.
Yes.
That may have actually helped get to that place in the first instance. A fair amount of people come to me terrified of eating anything in case it feeds their cancer.
Yes.
And that's an approach that I can fully understand, because there's so much information out there, this might feed cancer, this might feed cancer, this might feed cancer. And people come in literally eating very little, almost nothing at all, and terrified that if they eat the wrong thing, it might feed their cancer. And that fear is, in my opinion, worse than what any of those foods would have done had they eaten them. The impact of stress on the body can be really debilitating, because it's a helpful thing in the short term. If a tiger was to jump into the room right now, then my stress responses may even save my life in that instance. But if I get stuck in them long term, what happens is the main stress response is for not just the frontal lobe of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, to downgrade, but also the digestive system and the reproductive organs and anything that's not essential. So if we've downgraded our digestive system, for example, then that person's not going to be able to digest and absorb nutrients that it needs to really thrive. In the short term, it might be a life-saving technique. In the long term, it can then contribute to lots of debilitating conditions and diseases, because there's that inability to absorb the fundamental nutrition that you need. And at the same time, that will create situations of inflammation and dysbiosis in the gut. And we now know so much more about how the gut's microbiome is really the front line of the immune system. So if that's not happy, then the immune system isn't going to be functioning well at all. So the impact of stress on the body is really quite profound, and something that we need to be continually working with, whether we've had a diagnosis or not.
So it's interesting to hear, I mean, you use the same word, stress, when you're talking about sort of obviously external stressful situations, you know, lack of money, I've got cancer, whatever it is. And things like eating the wrong foods are also stressful, but not on your mind. Obviously, they're stressful directly to your body. But in a way, you're saying these are actually the same thing from the body's point of view. It's dealing with something out of kilter, if you like, something which is out of balance. And the same kind of things go wrong in response to the different kinds of stress.
Yeah, I mean, it very much can be. The thing with that information, though, is to not then use that as an inroad into, well, I'm scared to eat anything now. So that's what I'm trying to avoid. Yeah. So having an understanding that, yes, if you eat lots of foods that you know are going to, so say you know that you're intolerant to gluten, for example, and I'd say most people are probably at least a tiny bit intolerant to gluten, but maybe aren't immediately aware of it because maybe they don't get a profound effect, or maybe the effect is a few hours or a couple of days later, so they're just not even noticing it. But it is quite a difficult protein to work with in the digestive tract. And although as a species we are gradually evolving to deal with it, there's still so many people that aren't so good at that. So gluten will enter the digestive tract, get partially broken down to something like to gluteomorphine, and the gluteomorphine can then create inflammation, sometimes damage in the gut, and it can interact with neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, GABA, and we now know that most of those are made in the digestive tract. And then you've got food coming in that's interfering with those. So it's causing inflammation, or contributing at least to inflammation, contributing to dysbiosis, contributing to neurotransmitter disruption. That's pretty stressful, yeah. Actually. Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily mean that one should be fearful of eating gluten, because that fear in itself can have a similar response. It may mean for some people that they have to completely avoid gluten, at least for a while. But for other people, it may just mean thinking, okay, well, you know what, I'm just not going to have that in my regular daily diet. But if I'm somewhere where that's the only option, or, you know, or if there's a special occasion and someone's made me something and it's got gluten in, I'm not going to have a song and dance about it. I'm going to enjoy it.
Right.
It's having that kind of approach to things. And I think that's really important. Unless somebody has like a serious allergy to something and it's going to have an immediate debilitating impact,
right.
We continually should be weighing up the, you know, what's the least stress. If I go to a friend's house and they've cooked me dinner and it's got something in there that I know my digestive system is going to have a hard time with, I have two choices. I can either say to my friend, sorry, I'm not going to eat that because of this, or I can say to my friend, thank you, that looks amazing, I really appreciate the fact that you've cooked for me, I'm going to eat it. And neither of those is the right or wrong approach, but it's my decision. That's my decision to make, and I feel empowered to make that decision each time that occurs. And that process of making the decision takes a lot of the stress out of it. And it also takes a lot of the judgment out of it. We judge ourselves a lot through food. So it might be something like a fast food hamburger or something. And we might say, oh, that food is bad. I've had some of that today, therefore I'm a bad person. We make that leap in the same sentence a lot. And we say, I've been bad today, I've had such and such.
Right. Yeah.
And so that is judging ourselves through the food that we eat. We do that very easily. We have this emotional relationship to our food that's evolved through all kinds of self-preservation reasons, and the whole evolution of that and theories around that are quite fascinating. But we need to be careful that we're not playing into that too much. And anything we can do to just step aside from any kind of judgments, any kind of thoughts around what we should do, what we shouldn't do, what we should have, and what we shouldn't have. And instead, kind of step back and say, okay, well, what feels most appropriate right now? What's going to nourish me most right now? If we can make all of our food decisions in that way, I just think that would be amazing.
All right. Yeah, sounds good. Okay, so I've got one more thing on the sort of connectedness thing I've been pursuing here, which I wanted to talk about. It was just about integrative medicine itself. It seems to me that what sets integrative medicine apart from conventional medicine is this very view of connectedness, as it does fundamentally alter the approach a practitioner takes. As medicine, it becomes a question of balance and homeostasis rather than repairing things or inhibiting them or blocking them or even destroying them. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I would agree with that. And really just doing what we can to support the amazing stuff our bodies can do already. Because if we interfere too much, we might be messing with something, you know, touching on something that really has horrendous implications further down the line that we're not even aware of. Whereas if we just put a nice underground support network in and keep an eye on balance and homeostasis, that's much less intrusive and theoretically less likely to push something else out of balance without realising or meaning to.
And do you want to just talk a little bit about homeostasis? I just threw it out there, but actually some people may not be familiar with the term and its relevance.
Yeah, well, it's kind of what I was talking about before with temperature, really. If it's too cold, if we're in a really cold climate and it's snowy and icy outside, then our bodies will do things to warm up because our internal environment needs particular conditions for all the biochemistry to happen and for everything to keep flowing. So if the temperature isn't right, for example, then it will switch on a fan or it will switch on a heating system to bring it to the right level. Similarly with levels of hydration in the body, so certain functions need quite a lot of hydration, so the body will try and make sure that those parts of the body get more hydrated at certain times when we need them more. It's probably why a lot of women get bloated around the time of their period, because it's a time when the body's preparing for pregnancy. If there is a pregnancy, that's going to need a lot more water to make a baby and a sac filled with the amniotic fluid and all the extra tissue for the woman actually having been pregnant as well. So it's starting to stockpile a bit of water for there. So our bodies are quite intelligent. We have so many different measuring systems and continually measuring how much of this is there in the blood, how much of that is there. And if there's too much, we'll wee some of it out. If there's not enough, we'll try and grab it from somewhere. So if there's not enough calcium in the blood, for example, then we can quite easily take some from the bones just to make sure that there's enough in the blood to service everything else. So that's really what homeostasis is about. It's the body doing the best it can to self-regulate. Now, of course, if our calcium intake is low, or actually more likely, that's very rarely the case, that sometimes people have issues with calcium misplacement. So part of our stress response, in fact, can include there's certain minerals that can become electrolytes in the body, like magnesium and calcium and potassium and sodium. And what they're basically doing is helping water move around the body. They're flowing with water around the body, so they keep everything moving. And part of our stress response is that freeze, frozen thing, and we kind of stop moving for a while. And calcium, for example, can build up in tissue cells in that situation. There are other things that can influence that as well, that kind of allowing calcium to build up in the tissues and get kind of held on there. And so the blood can sometimes sense, oh, I'm a bit low in calcium now, or we need some calcium for something and it's not really there. So it will take it out of the bones to do that. And if that situation goes on long term, then eventually, obviously, the bones are going to be depleted of calcium, and there might be an osteoporosis situation going on there. So it will do its best, but there are limits, and at some point we have to make sure that we are feeding our bodies what they need, that we're digesting and absorbing it well, and that it's actually able to flow and get to where it needs to go. And stress is, because of that freeze response that comes with stress, it can get in the way of all of that. So we really need to, homeostasis is our body's primary aim and intention with everything, because that's when things work best. But something as simple as stress, long-term stress, can put a bit of a spanner in the network there, in the machinery.
Hence the importance of looking at it. But also it's interesting that with the kind of view you've just put out, of course, people such as nutritionists or other kinds of integrative medicine practitioners do have all sorts of resources at hand to actually support the body in regaining homeostasis when things are really off balance.
Yes, there are lots of things out there that people can go and do or be supported with. And it's amazing that people have so much choice. And it's brilliant that there are people like you, Robin, making everyone aware of those choices. Because I know that when I was ill, when I had cancer, which was probably about 20 years ago, I knew I wanted something different, but I didn't have access to it. I didn't know what different was. It just wasn't there. Whereas now it's still not perfect, but because of people like you, there's so much more education and access to different ways of supporting your body, different approaches. So huge amounts of gratitude for that.
Well, it's
important
stuff, isn't it?
It can feel a bit like, now there's too much choice. What am I supposed to do? And that's a stress in itself for some people. But again, it's just that settling in, like I was saying, with making decisions about what to eat. If we can just kind of step aside from the stress and anxiety a little, just step back and breathe and just kind of listen to what our bodies are actually wanting. That can really help guide us towards the right kind of thing that we need right now. I'm aware that that's not a scientific sounding approach, but it is one that generally works and will help to mostly guide people towards some, you know, there's some really good stuff out there from people with amazing integrity and commitment to what they're doing.
Okay, so we've talked quite a bit about stress and nutrition. We've mentioned the immune system, but I want to sort of home in on the immune system now, because of course for people with cancer, the immune system is something that's out of balance. It's usually depleted in some way, and that's how the whole situation's managed to come about. So these things, nutrition, stress, the immune system, they're all deeply connected. You can start from any of them and you're still going to arrive at the same kind of places. But can we start from the immune system now and just look outward at the ways in which nutrition and stress are directly affecting the immune system?
Yeah, okay, so one pathway that you could perhaps look at is that when you've been stressed for a long time, your cortisol levels will most likely be high for a long time. I mean, not everybody fits the mold of that, but it's a common pattern. Cortisol is a natural anti-inflammatory. It gets released in stress. Imagine you've got a dodgy ankle and you have to run away from a situation, it would just help to take the edge off that so that you can run. And it does a few other things as well. It helps to break down kind of metabolize some energy very quickly so that you've got some instant energy to do that with. So cortisol gets released with stress, and in long-term stress it can stay high. So you'd think that would be great, brilliant, on tap anti-inflammatory hormone. But how that works is the cortisol, like all hormones, it travels through the bloodstream to where it needs to go, and then it gives some instructions to a bunch of cells. Now, those cells have to have cortisol receptors on their outsides in order to be able to hear that instruction. Mm-hmm. In long-term stress, the cortisol receptors don't work as efficiently. So your adrenals can be continually sending out cortisol, but it never actually gets to give that message of, right, calm inflammation down, because it's not being listened to by the cells. So what happens there is that any inflammation that occurs, inflammation is a brilliant thing, it's a healing response. But when something's healed, then it calms down again. In long-term stress, you don't have that fully calming down again, so you can end up with chronic inflammatory conditions because it's essentially cortisol resistance, just like insulin resistance. Right. So then it becomes, you've got this kind of chronic underlying inflammation, and that really does seem to underpin every chronic illness I've looked at, whether it's cancer, diabetes, heart disease, any chronic disease. There's inflammation there, and there's studies now on how, when inflammation cells, when they actually turn into cancer cells and what that process is. So that's one influence of stress that we can look at. We can also look at it from the point of view of the microbiome, so the community of microbes, so bacteria and viruses and so on in the gut. And they directly impact the immune system. So they instruct the immune system sometimes in how to behave. They give the immune system or the white blood cells information about what's going on. They also can regulate inflammation. So the state of the gut microbiome is hugely important too. And just as we can help the adrenals calm down its cortisol response, we can also help with diet to influence the microbiome. Right. And we're increasingly learning how to do that with things like dietary fiber and ratio of fats in our diet, and of course fermented foods and probiotics and that kind of thing. So there's that whole realm as well. And we also know that we need things like vitamin A to make really good, healthy white blood cells in our immune system. And there are various other vitamins and minerals that are really helpful too. Zinc is incredibly useful. And there's a lot of research around a whole host of medicinal mushrooms. So shiitake mushrooms, for example, can help make more and better quality white blood cells. So that's already three ways that we can impact the immune system via diet.
Mm. So a very core relationship, really. And I know you love talking about the gut bacteria and how important it is. We've also talked about this sort of two-way relationship with the environment. Well, there's a growing understanding of the what you would think was a kind of common sense relationship between the soil's biome, where our food comes from, and our own gut biome, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's fascinating the more that unfolds, and people that have gone out and kind of studied the poo of tribes, people that are still living quite, relatively traditional lifestyles, and comparing it to our poo and how it's all so different. The increasing understanding that we have that our internal microbiome isn't just influenced by our mother, so coming through the birth canal, being breastfed, that kind of thing, but actually everyone we come into regular contact with. So if you share a house with somebody for several years, you're probably going to be exchanging communities of microbes. But not necessarily all of them. So, we're quite selective, or we can be quite selective as well. We can shake hands with somebody and decide on somehow, I don't know that anyone really quite understands how yet, not to pick up their microbes.
Right.
Or do pick up their microbes. So it's, yeah, there's some selectiveness there that I don't think we fully understand yet, but it's really fascinating how it's evolving. And it's really helping to shape the whole question of kind of catching diseases and catching viruses as well, because there's been a kind of naturopathic debate for a long time about whether you catch things or whether they're lying internally dormant and your own internal environment wakes up certain microbes that might then cause disease. But, you know, I see us as very much part of this bigger ecosystem on our planet. So it's not just about what's internal. There's very much an external influence. So the soil in our back garden, the microbes that we come into contact with on a daily basis, we are going to have a relationship with that. That's going to inform our health, how our bodies respond, our mood, our behaviour. We're all part of that.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating topic, isn't it? And you know, an increased understanding of like the mechanism you were describing, whereby we pick up some bugs and not others, for example, that could be such valuable information, couldn't it?
Oh, really? Absolutely. And one day we'll make good use of that, I'm sure. Mm. And I'm so glad this area of research has been taken so seriously by so many scientists right now. And a lot of it is the speed at which actually general members of the public are informing themselves about this or becoming aware. In the past, sometimes it's taken a couple of decades for bits of new nutrition information to filter out through.
Right.
Whereas now people are really keeping up to speed with what's going on and really helping to work with that. And of course, it's very easy to go off in tangents with stuff, to misunderstand information, to not appreciate that it's just a tiny piece of the picture, and instead to take one piece of information and hang everything on it. We like to do that as human beings, and it's more difficult to be a bit more patient about it and a bit more curious and just go, oh, that's interesting. Where can we put this in? Does it fully work yet? No matter, let's just keep aware of it and see where it does work. We want to make use of everything now and change everything now. But we do have to be more patient.
Yeah.
But it is exciting. We can appreciate that.
But, you know, despite the fact we are now, you know, most of the public will tell you, oh yeah, we're mostly bugs, the concept that we could disinfect them out of our lives somehow is going to take a long time to die, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. It takes a while for us to kind of, we're good at brainwashing ourselves, because it's like, there's so much to deal with in life, I think, Robin, that we try and simplify things when we can. It's easier to free up headspace when things aren't too complex. So we like to put things in simple, neat little boxes and go, right, I've understood that, I've ticked that, that's all done.
Mm.
It just makes life so much easier. Right. So when something comes along and says, oh, actually, it's not as easy as that, we don't necessarily want to take the new information on board. Or on some levels we can, but it's quite difficult to let go of that old, oh, it's all right if we just disinfect everything, that old mentality. It can be really difficult to let go of that because we like those boxes. And also, we don't fully understand, we don't want to completely open the box and let all the bugs in, because that's how it was before we disinfected everything, and that wasn't great either.
Right.
So I think, you know, people are right to be a bit cautious and think, okay, well, how can we actually work with this in a way that's going to be helpful, rather than just dive into something that we don't fully understand.
Yeah.
I can understand that.
Yeah, me too. Well,
I often think back to my granddad not washing his potatoes because he wanted a bit of the dirt on them.
Right.
Get me going through life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, we're coming towards the end. Just a quick crystal ball gazing question. Given the direction of our growing understandings of the workings of the human body, what kind of treatments do you think we'll be using in 10 years' time?
Oh, goodness, there's a question. I'm hoping that there, and I think there is a movement towards this, I'm hoping that we'll have a lot more sense of, that giving our bodies a sense of space, actually. So rather than overloading bodies with things to make it better or things to do, things to work with, actually just finding a temporary kind of mountaintop or field to sit in and work very simply with one or two things that are just going to gently ease the person back into, back, gently nudge someone back into homeostasis.
So less clobbering and more supporting and easing.
Yes, that's what I would very much like to see.
It makes sense.
More listening to what the body needs rather than telling it what it needs. Mm-hmm. So more kind of maybe more tools, designs too, and I think these are already coming about, that even the medical world is starting to understand a lot more that different things suit different people, and if you can look at why those people are different, then you might be able to figure out what's more appropriate for them. I think that is starting to happen a lot more, but to really have that approach a lot more of listening to what each person needs as an individual, rather than just saying, this is my model of treatment, I'm going to force it on you.
Right. Genuine personalised care.
Yeah, that would be great.
It would. Okay, well, look, we're going to leave it there. Thanks very much, Kirsten. It was a great chat. I'm looking forward very much to seeing you at your talk, 4 Years to Life, in Brighton next month.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that too. Will you be there?
I will.
Fabulous. Great. Thank you for today. Really enjoyed that.
As you heard, Kirsten is speaking at a Yes to Life event in Brighton. It's on the 23rd of May at 6:30 p.m. at the Old Ship Hotel, right down by the seafront. I plan to be there and I'd love to meet any of you who are able to come. Do introduce yourselves. Also in May, on the 12th, is the Yes to Life Spring Conference and Workshops. This is a new sort of event for us. Conference in the morning, workshops in the afternoon. It's at the China Exchange in Soho, London, and it's called Mind Your Body. And if you want to go, book very soon in order to get your top choice of workshop places. The event will feature Wendy Sajazy from the US, nutritionist Liz Butler, and journey specialist Gabby Burt. For booking these events, go to yestolife.org.uk and follow the links from the homepage. Also on the homepage is a Yes to Life show logo. Click this for links to material related to today's show. I hope you enjoyed the show today and can join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.